It's a striking thing about Darwinism that it has, more than any other American science, provided such a comprehensive worldview that you can do evolutionary all sorts of things. There is evolutionary ethics, evolutionary epistemology, and I think there is a worthwhile evolutionary theology as well. And it's a contribution to that that I want to make this evening. And just as a footnote to that, there's an intriguing question of why it is that some areas of science raise much more far-reaching theological questions than others. And I'm inclined to the view that the interface between theology and science is largely a metaphysical one, and it's areas of science that raise a lot of metaphysical issues that have most to do with theology. And in the contemporary scene, it seems to me that, for example, chemistry isn't currently raising a lot of metaphysical issues and doesn't currently have a very rich interface with theology, though historically it's a rather different situation, but I think that's true of the contemporary situation. I think evolutionary theology has been very fruitful for theology, actually quite transformative to begin to do theology in evolutionary context. And even though we do this for over 100 years now, I think in a sense we still haven't quite thought through the implications of this and realized the potential of it. And those of you who listen to sermons quite regularly, as I do myself, will realize that there's still a lot of pre-evolutionary thinking being conveyed in sermons. I think the church really hasn't in that sort of parish level really digested the implications of evolution. There's still quite a lot of work to be done. I think it's been a very fruitful impact that almost every point where you can see evolution having an impact on theology, I think it's been an impact for the better. Aubrey Moore in the 19th century talked about Darwin appearing in the guise of a foe but actually doing the work of a friend. And I think Darwinism has done the work of a friend at almost every point. The particular example that Aubrey Moore had in mind when he made that remark was that Darwinism was helpful in nudging theological thinking from a doctrine of creation that placed too much emphasis on the origin, on a single act of creation at a particular point in time at the beginning, but very little sense of creation as a continuing process. I think Aubrey Moore's point was that evolution helped us to see how the creation of species was an ongoing process. That if evolution was the way in which God had created species, this had gone on for a long time. It wasn't just a once-for-all moment. And that had helped Christian theology to recover a doctrine of creatio continua, the continuing nature of creation. I would suggest that on balance it's been helpful for biblical thesis as well. Though that's a somewhat mixed picture. And one has to admit that there have been sections in the Christian community that have reacted against Darwinism and retreated into a kind of extreme literalist interpretation of the Bible that is often presented as being traditionalist, but is actually not. It is a new kind of literalism that is an innovative reaction to Darwinism rather than just a continuation of what there was before. And Christian thinkers have always been quite sophisticated about the Bible, or at least the best of them, and how to interpret it. And it's worth remembering Augustine's masterful commentary on Genesis, where his basic principle is that it is a mistake to interpret literally any parts of Genesis which, so interpreted, would bring you into conflict with established facts. And if you do that, you risk bringing the whole of the scriptures into disrepute. I think there's a kind of wisdom there that it would be helpful for some of our contemporary biblical literalists to take on board. But on balance, I think Darwinism has helped us to be clearer about what kind of material we are dealing with, Bible, in particular, what kind of material we're dealing with in Genesis, and that is not meant to be a scientific textbook about cosmology or the creation of species. It's doing a different kind of job, answering different kind of questions. On balance, I think Darwinism has nudged us towards accepting that. Another person who sort of anticipated that quite helpfully, I think, was Galileo in his quip that the Bible teaches us how to go to heaven, not how the heavens go. And I think Darwin's been helpful as well in a reframing of natural theology. And he's become increasingly aware that the origin of species did not spell the end of natural theology. Natural theology continued very vigorously for quite some time after Darwin. But I think it did change the character of it. And if you take the kind of natural theology you find in Paley at the beginning of the 19th century, there is an attempt to provide a knockdown argument for the existence of God. If you look at something as well designed as many species are for their habitats, camels so well designed for going long distances in the desert without water, you are led to conclude that there must be a designer. There is no alternative explanation. And I think Darwin moves us away from that kind of natural theology to a natural theology that takes the facts of the natural world seriously, but interprets them in a theological way. It leads from a natural theology that attempts to be an art to a natural theology that is a mode of interpretation. And for me, that's a much more sensible and appropriate and sustainable kind of natural theology. And I think Darwin helped us to make that transition. I think Darwin's also been helpful in adjusting our view of human nature. And if you look at why it was that so many people reacted against Darwin in the early days after the Origin of Species, then I think a strong candidate for that is that it upset people's ideas about human nature. And one of the clues that points in that direction, in my view, is that there was a significant body of people in the early days after the Origins who accepted evolution for the rest of species, but not for humans. It was the idea that humans had evolved from other species that stuck in their throats and could not be accepted. And so the problem, I think, with Darwinism for a lot of people was that they had a rather exalted view of human dignity. And that can get dressed up in religious terms, but it would be a mistake to do that. And authentic Christian theology has always tried to maintain a balance between the twin dots, that human beings are made in the image of God, but are also fallen. It's wanted to maintain both things and to hold those in creative tension. And in the period before Darwin, I think it's arguable that those things have got somewhat out of balance, and that there was a stronger emphasis on human dignity and less emphasis on the fallenness of humans. And it seems that Darwin, with his emphasis on the struggle for survival, helped us to an awareness of the fallenness, both of the whole of the natural world, but human beings included. And that was initially, I think, somewhat distasteful for Darwin's contemporaries, but I think it's nudged us back to a more balanced theological view of human nature that people have before. So at various points, I would want to argue that doing theology in Darwinian context has been theologically fruitful. It's not just making the best of a bad job, adjusting to a new and difficult context, it has actually been helpful for those who practice Christian theology. But for the most part, it has been done in a way which has made rather heavy use of the idea of progress. And that's what I mainly want to focus on this evening. And I want to suggest that the idea of progress in evolutionary theology is unnecessary and unlovable. And I want to try and argue that out. And it's useful to put this in historical context. Because Darwin's book was published at a time when there was a very strong sense of human progress. And so evolutionary thought naturally came with that kind of spin. Not so much with Darwin himself. I think the idea of progress is much stronger in Herbert Spencer than it is in Darwin, but I'm persuaded by scholars like Michael Ruse that the idea of progress is there in Darwin if you look for it, albeit in a slightly muted form. But looking back, it seems that the idea of progress was overstrong in that late 19th century period. And by the 1920s even, Berry was writing his notable book on the rise and fall of the idea of progress, already in the 1920s, referring to the rise and fall of the idea of progress. It's the same period that produced the sense of historical progress that you find in Marx. But we have moved on from that. And this idea of progress, this assumption of progress, is much less compelling for us now than it was for Darwin's contemporaries. So I think it's entirely understandable that Darwin's contemporaries made heavy use of the idea of progress, but we live in a different context, and it's less natural for us to invoke that idea, and I think it's appropriate for us to do that. It's an idea that is also rather debatable from a theological point of view. And one can see salvation history as a kind of gradual improvement, things getting better and better. But that is really, as Dean Inge once remarked, a monstrous distortion of Christian theology. But yet again, the idea of progress has run into deep disfavor amongst evolutionary thinkers. And I suppose that is perhaps one of the most compelling reasons why it needs to be abandoned now in evolutionary theology, which is going to have any credibility. One of the people who's expressed that view most trenchantly is Stephen Jay Gould, who remarked that progress is a noxious, culturally embedded, untestable, non-operational, intractable idea. So in evolutionary thinking, he won none of it. And I'm quite happy to go with that. And let me say at least that I don't think evolutionary theology needs to make any use of the idea of progress. It's easy, though, to see how in the late 19th century progress was the glue that held together a sense of evolutionary progress with a sense of salvation history, and in both of them things seemed to be getting better and better. So you had two different Whiggish stories about how things were getting better and better, not difficult to work out some kind of synthesis of them, as you find in Lux Mundi, for example, published in the 1890s. But I think in our time we want to do it differently, and are better doing it differently. So if we're not going to make use of the idea of progress, what can we say instead? Well, I want here to follow Francesco Ayala in making the move to talking about directional change, not progress, directional change. Even that is going a little bit further than some evolutionary scientists are comfortable with going. But I think that's because they're unjustifiably squeamish about the idea, and it seems to me that the idea of directional change is not only defensible, it is unavoidable. That there clearly has been a direction in evolution. It is not a random chaotic process. If you turn the fossil record upside down, it wouldn't really make sense. There is clearly some kind of direction going on here. A bit more debate, though, about what the direction is, and there have been various candidates for that advance. And one quite popular idea is that of Julian Huxley, that there is a movement towards greater complexity. But complexity is a rather slippery notion, and I wouldn't quite want to frame it that way myself. I'm actually happier with a formulation of Ayala's, that the movement is towards the ability to perceive the environment and to integrate, coordinate, and react flexibly to what is perceived. Or in other words, it's a movement towards increasingly good information processing. And it's not difficult to see why, in evolutionary terms, information processing has such significant advantage. It's more obvious why information processing has advantage than why complexity has advantage. And complexity maybe has advantages, but it's not kind of inevitable. But if you have species that know increasingly well what is going on in their environment and can respond appropriately to it, then there's clearly going to be evolutionary advantage in that. So no difficulty, I think, with this claim that there has been directional change towards increasingly good information processing. There was such advantage in good information processing that it was perhaps inevitable that evolution would move in that direction somehow or other, sooner or later. But I want to be cautious in how I frame that claim, and I certainly don't want to be thought to be making the claim that there was anything inevitable about evolution proceeding exactly as it did. I certainly don't think that. There could have been all sorts of routes by which we got to species that had good information processing. So I'm not making any claims about the inevitability of the particular route, just making claims about the evolutionary advantages of information processing, and in that sense the inevitability of moving in that direction somehow or other. I also don't want to make any strong claims about human beings, about Homo sapiens. I don't think there is anything inevitable about evolution throwing up human beings. And in this, I think I take a softer view than my Cambridge colleague Simon Conway Morris does, who I think wants to make stronger claims about the inevitability of human beings. I just want to claim that there is an inevitability about a species arising in the end, somehow or other, that will have the kind of good capacity for information processing that humans have. But that species doesn't have to be us in every detail. It's not necessary that that species has five fingers and all the rest of it. It doesn't have to be exactly us. And I want to be careful here that I'm not implying that there's anything particularly good about humans. One of the reasons why evolutionary theorists often react very badly against ideas of progress is that they suspect that there is a claim that evolution has been moving towards the best species. And best is a big concept with all sorts of ramifications and resonance. And it involves a lot of value judgments that are being made by human beings who are not neutral in this matter, and I fully accept all the problems about that. But I think I can still claim that there is a certain inevitability in evolution moving towards a species such as us that has good information processing, without saying either that it has to be us or that there is anything particularly good about us in a broad sense. And theologians, of course, have no vested interest in wanting to claim that humans are, in every sense, a good species. And I come back to what I said earlier on about the theological anthropology needing to hold together an idea of being made in the image of God with an idea of the fallenness of humanity. You need to hold those two ideas together. So I think sensible evolutionary thinking and sensible theological thinking are moving in the same direction. So, not progress, but directional change. And interpreting the long march of evolution towards a species such as ourselves is, I think, a helpful way of cashing out the way that the process of creation of species has proceeded. But it can be done without the idea of progress and avoids considerable problems if it's done without the idea of us and with a more modest idea of directional change. I want to move on now and to try and connect these ideas a bit more with Christian salvation history and to talk a little bit about the fall and then about Christ. The fall, the story in Genesis 3, the story of Adam and Eve eating the apple in the Garden of Eden, has been a very influential one in Christendom. And most people would now assume that it cannot be interpreted in a literal way. And I would completely agree with that. But most people want to go further than that, and I think want to go further than is necessary, and to say that it should not be taken in a historical way at all, that it's either to be taken as a sort of flat ontological statement about human nature, or perhaps as conveying eschatological thinking about the future possibility for God's creation, but presenting this in the form of a myth about an initial paradise. I want to connect it a little bit more with how evolution happened. And I want to suggest that the story of the fall in Genesis 3 conveys in mythological form something that must have happened in general terms as Homo sapiens emerged. And it's a myth that seems to focus on one of the key characteristics, the cognitive accompaniments of Homo sapiens, and that is the ability to make conceptual distinctions. That's something that I would assume we can do much more ably than any of our primate ancestors. And the story of Genesis 3 seems to be describing that acquisition of the capacity for conceptual distinctions. And it does that in two ways, one explicitly, one implicitly. The explicit one is about good and evil, right at the heart of the story, that human beings eat the fruit and acquire the knowledge of good and evil, knowledge of that conceptual distinction that they hadn't had previously. The capacity for conceptual distinctions is right at the heart of the story. And there's another conceptual distinction that's there more implicitly, which is the distinction between God and humanity. at the start of the story, Adam and Eve were still able to walk in the garden with God in the cool of the evening, scarcely conscious of the distinction between God and themselves. But by the end of the story, they do have that rather sharp sense of conceptual distinction between God and themselves, and are embarrassed about their nakedness and all the rest of it. Seems to me a myth about the acquisition of conceptual distinctions in emerging humanity. And that, in a sense, stands for the whole range of distinctive cognitive capacities that human beings have. It's difficult to be balanced about human distinctiveness, and claims about how similar or different human beings are from other species tend to get intertwined with religious positions, and religious people tend to want to make stronger claims about human distinctiveness than atheists do. I think it's unfortunate that scientific issues about human distinctiveness have got rather caught up in the God wars, and I want to try and steer a sort of balanced path through that. And on the one hand, I'm happy to admit that pretty much every cognitive accomplishment of human beings has precursors in our primate ancestors, but that there are a significant number of things that we're so much better at than any of our primate ancestors. So chimps can do language a bit. And interestingly, second generation chimps who are the children of other chimps who have a bit of language, are particularly good at it. But we are vastly better at language than any other species. So happy to admit precursors, but still wanting to say that we are much better at many cognitive accomplishments, including the capacity for conceptual distinctions, which is the one that Genesis focuses on. Let's relate this back to the idea of progress. Is this development for better or for worse? The fall has traditionally presented as being a development for worse. And you can see how that arises, that human beings have a capacity for choices, for deliberate knowing choices that other species seem not to have in the same way. And if you take it to be a defining feature of the concept of sin, that you need to make a knowing and deliberate choice. That's a debatable point. A lot of ideas about sin do make that assumption. Then human beings seem to have the capacity to make deliberate choices, which makes sin possible for them. It's not that other species can't be mostly destructive, but they just don't know what they're doing sufficiently well for it to be appropriate to call it sin. So in that sense, this cognitive development that seems to be summarized in the Genesis 3 story has led human beings to have a capacity for sin that it didn't have before. And if there's anything that justifies it being called the fall, that's it. But it's not only sin and evil that human beings have a capacity for. It seems to me that they also have a capacity for a different kind of altruism than other species have. We've been made aware by the sociologist Richard Dawkins and others the extent to which you can find altruism in other species. You can find reciprocal altruism and so on. But I want to argue that there is a distinctive kind of altruism that you find in human beings that's different from what you find in other species, what you might call a knowing psychological altruism. It's a point of view that's been argued, for example, by Sober and Wilson in their excellent book, and others. So, though it is a fall into the capacity for sin, It's also a movement into a capacity for a new kind of tune. It's morally ambivalent, I think. So I don't want to read too much into this story in Genesis 3 about either a movement into depravity or a movement into virtue. It seems to me morally ambiguous, and we can actually understand what's going on better there if we leave aside these ideas about depravity and virtue and put the focus more on the conceptual enhancement that is what the story is primarily about. It may seem as though I'm making it less of a story of sin than it's often taken to be, but the story actually doesn't refer to sin at all, as James Barr points out in his very good book on the Garden of Eden. And in the Augustinian West, we read it as being a story about sin much more than the text really supports. And if you look at how the story has been received in other traditions, in the non-Augustinian Christian East, or in the Jewish community, you find that it's interpreted in terms of sin much less than it is in Western Christendom. And as I said, I think our Augustinian inheritance is so strong that we read more into it in that regard than is really there. Let me just digress a moment and say something about how this relates to current ideas about the evolution of religion. It seems to me not surprising to say that as human beings emerge, there is a tendency to make increasingly clear conceptual distinctions, that the movement in cognitive development in children and in evolution is likely to be a movement from undifferentiation to greater differentiation. What is very odd about the current orthodoxy about the evolution of religion that is being peddled at the moment, one that emanates from people like Pascal Boyer, is that it seems to turn that on its head and to suggest, I'm putting a little bit of a gloss on what people like Boyer say, but I think it's a fair interpretation of it. And unless you make the kind of assumptions that I'm about to attribute to them, I think the whole theory lapses into incoherence. Central to the theory is an idea of domain violation. And there seems to be an implicit idea that emerging humanity has a clear distinction between the animate domain of living creatures and the inanimate domain. Things are neatly in boxes, and then something goes wrong, that you get domain violation, and somehow this distinction is lost. And emerging humanity starts applying into the inanimate world ideas that really belong to the animate world. So you get a collapse of differentiation. It seems to me that that's extremely implausible in developmental and evolutionary terms, that things move from differentiation to lack of differentiation. So I'd be very skeptical about that story about the evolution of religion on those grounds alone. Also, I noticed that it's a theory that has been advanced in the main by people who hold naturalistic assumptions at the beginning of the 21st century. And it seems to me that they're in danger of attributing their own naturalistic assumptions onto emerging humanity. That, of course, emerging humanity knew the natural world to be purely natural. That's what it is, as every 21st century naturalist knows. And, of course, emerging humanity must have known that. And then somehow, bizarrely, something went wrong. And how do you explain what went wrong? it seems to me entirely possible that naturalism is actually incorrect, and that emerging humanity has found it wasn't buying into naturalism, just got it right. It's perfectly possible, but to atheist naturalists of our time, that is almost an unthinkable idea. So I think there's a kind of a naturalism in the way that they're projecting back their own naturalistic assumptions on the ancient humanity. There's also something very strikingly unparsimonious about this idea of the evolution of animistic religious thought by the main violation. In the evolution of humanity, there is a cultural explosion. A whole package of things come together. Communal practices, cave art, and all the rest of it. And it seems to me much more sensible to offer a single explanation for why you get that whole package of developments that people call the cultural explosion, rather than to pick off individual developments like a move into religious thinking and to give separate explanations for each of those. It's a very unparsimonious way for science to proceed here. Much more sensible, it seems to me, to have a general view about the cognitive changes that were taking place in emerging humanity, and then to try to understand how the whole package of cultural developments that we see with emerging humanity arise from those developments in the cognitive architecture. And we're just beginning to get, a good and fairly convincing story of what the crucial development in the cognitive architecture is. And it would take me too far from my main theme to go into it in detail, but briefly, I think it is that all other species have just one central cognitive subsystem. Human beings uniquely have two central cognitive subsystems. One fairly propositional and associated with our capacity for language, and the other more intuitive. And I think it's having those dual cognitive systems that enables us to do a whole stack of things that other primates can't do, and which underpins our capacity for religion, amongst other things. And the last comment about this, I think the Pascal Boyer myth of domain violation is a bit like the myth of the fall turned upside down. But it kind of assumes that we have good and pure naturalism, and then something went catastrophically wrong to give rise to religion. It's a kind of myth of the fall, but inverted. Very strange. Anyway, I won't go further into that. I want to come to Christ and to attempts to put Christ in evolutionary context, which people have been doing since the late 19th century, and often making use of the idea of progress, which is all right up to a point, but I think is on its own does not give rise to a satisfactory evolutionary Christology. And again, to argue that evolutionary Christology doesn't need to make use of the idea of progress and is better not. Probably the most straightforward idea about Christ in the evolutionary context is that evolution provides the necessary precursors to make the incarnation possible. That it's only when you get a species such as ourselves that the good of information processing and all the other things associated with that, good at conceptual distinctions, good at relationships, good at language, all those things. Only when you have such a species is the incarnation possible. So in that sense, the evolution is the necessary preparation for the incarnation. And that enables you to present a doctrine of the finality of Christ, if you want to captured in those terms, that Christ is the kind of natural culmination of this phase of evolution. But what evolutionary theologians have found much more difficult to do is to give a satisfactory account of the work of Christ in evolutionary terms. And quite often things are presented in rather whiggish terms, sort of onwards and upwards terms, that there is a process of natural evolution that culminates in a species that's very good at all these conceptual capacities. That makes the incarnation possible. And then things just continue to improve after the incarnation, perhaps improving in slightly different ways, but still improving. And for people who take that kind of line, I think it's quite difficult for them to give a convincing account of why the incarnation was possible. Why, if we had this onwards and upwards progress that made the incarnation possible, and an onwards and upwards progress that goes on afterwards, why that progress could not just have continued? Why it was necessary to have Christ? There are, of course, two broadly different Christian traditions here. They're not, I think, completely opposite. There are way, no doubt ways of synthesizing them, one of which places stronger emphasis on Christ as a turning point in Christian and in human development, and others which are uncomfortable with the idea of Christ as a kind of rescue operation and want to emphasize that if Christ was planned and intended from the beginning, before anything went wrong. But as I say, I don't think at the end of the day those two ideas are completely irreconcilable. But I think it does help in giving an adequate evolutionary Christology to give a slightly stronger account of the difference that Christ makes to human development and how it proceeds in a different direction after Christ than the one that it was proceeding in beforehand. I'm beginning to use evolution in a slightly loose sense here, and let me acknowledge this. I'm using it in a way a biologist might, I think, in talking about the progress of evolutionary development that leads up to Christ. But then in talking about the progress that comes after Christ, I'm talking specifically about human evolution, what some people might call cultural evolution or the evolution of consciousness, and it's a debatable how close an analogy there is between those kinds of evolution and the biological evolution that led to the emergence of Homo sapiens. A very good book in this area is one by the distinguished biblical scholar Gerd Thiessen, Biblical Faith and Evolution Approach. Quite an old book now, and I think he sets out this distinction between biological and cultural evolution very well, and discusses the number of points, the similarities and differences that there are between them. It's a very good exposition, but he has a rare talent for interdisciplinary work. I think he's particularly well known for his work on the interface of theology and sociology. He also went off once and did a book on psychological aspects of Pauline Fraud, which is, I think, the best piece of psychological exegesis that anyone has ever done. And he's done a rather good book on evolutionary theology as well. It's an impressive achievement. In indicating what's distinctive about Christ, he's wanting to put the emphasis in the moral ethical area. And I think that is a candidate. And there has been a lot of debate amongst evolutionary thinkers from the 19th century about how to relate evolution and ethics. And some people like Herbert Spencer have been wanting to emphasize the extent to which the capacity for ethics is a culmination of the evolutionary process. Other people, interestingly, like Thomas Huxley in his lectures on ethics, have been wanting to emphasize the extent to which ethics is a reversal of evolutionary priorities. And it seems as though you have a bit of a conflict of views here, but actually I think there's no great debate here, and it's helpful again to bring Francesco Ayala into this, who in his work has made a very clear distinction between capacity for ethics and the content of ethics. And I think you can see the capacity for ethical functioning as a culmination of evolution. And that was the point that Spencer was properly making, though he sometimes strayed beyond it. And the content of ethics, which is not an outgrowth of evolution, isn't and doesn't need to be. I think there is no need, as I see it, for ethical values to be dictated by the authority of evolution. And Thiessen's point is that Christ provides a shift in ethical thinking and a kind of spiritual mutation, an introduction of the love principle. It's a possible candidate for evolutionary Christology, but not actually the one I find most convincing, so I'm not going to spend longer on it. I want to suggest that the theories of the psychologist C.G. Jung can be applied quite fruitfully in this area. And you can do that drawing an analogy between the development of the individual, the human individual, and the development of the species. It's an analogy that's often been drawn. And Jung's story is of two stages in human lifespan. There's a first stage when the task is the development of ego consciousness. And what Jung means by that is fairly similar to what Freud means by it. It is the capacity to engage with external reality. But then, unlike Freud, Jung has an idea of the task of the second half of life, which is where the ego establishes a connection with the self. Technical concept, the higher, more complete person that we have the capacity to become, and if things go well, a helpful access is set up between ego and self that enables the person to move to a realization of the self, this higher and more complete person. If you draw an analogy between that and human evolution, then I think you have quite a helpful framework in which to contextualize Christ in evolutionary terms. And the development of the ego is really what corresponds to the fall of humanity, this development of distinctive cognitive capacities, which is what the ego does, and which incidentally gives us a distinctive capacity for good and for evil. And that can run on, but it is a limited mode of existence. And at some point, both the human individual and humanity as a whole glimpses the possibility of something bigger. And I think you can say that there's an analogy between the human person in the middle of life reconnecting the ego with the self, this higher, more complete person, and the incarnation of Christ. And humanity establishing a connection between its rather limited ego-based consciousness and the more developed spiritual consciousness that it is being called towards. So I think there's a fruitful kind of analogy there that could be develop further, and which would enable us to place Christ in evolutionary context. And I want to suggest again that that is best done without the idea of progress. That they're, in a sense, moving on from ego to this axis between ego and self, it is a kind of advance. It is also an advance that is bought at the price of some sacrifice, that the ego needs to recognize its poverty and limitations before this change is possible. It is not simply progress. It is not a Whiggish story of onwards and upwards. And one last idea about how one can present Christ in evolutionary context. And this comes from the 20th century English thinker Owen Barfield, one of the so-called Inklings. Barfield was one of the group of four people, including C.S. Lewis himself, Tolkien and Charles Williams, who were known as the Inklings. Barfield had a fictional and poetic output like the others, but that aspect of his work is not very well known. But he was probably the deepest philosopher of the group. And I think quite an influential figure in the Inklings for those who are interested in this bit of intellectual history. And Jack Lewis, who was, not given to humility, once conceded that he had learned considerably more from Barfield than Barfield had learned from him. Though they had quite a feisty relationship that they sometimes called their Great War. Barfield has an interesting idea about the evolution of consciousness, that there is a discernible change in the way that human beings connect with the spiritual world. If you go back into animistic thought, the assumption is that the spiritual world is speaking through the natural world, humanity. That's the progress. From spirit through nature to humanity. But then you have the emergence of a different kind of direction, when the spirit is not so much experienced from without. That kind of animistic thinking that experiences the spirit world as speaking to humanity through the natural world, that just seems to be coming. And what Barfield suggests is developing to replace it. Is the spirit as an inner activity. So there is now a capacity for human beings to look at the natural world with spirit-imbued eyes, that there is a new capacity for the spirit to be within and to open the minds and hearts of humanity to look at nature in a fresh way. It's a change of direction that he's prepared to argue as a philologist, which was his professional expertise. And I don't think it's a completely persuasive case that he makes out for this change in the direction of human consciousness, but it's a plausible and interesting case. And then he wants to make a further move of suggesting that this change happened about the time of Christ. And it is remarkably consonant with the things the New Testament says about the gift of the Spirit to be within. And his proposal is that it is a way of understanding the work of Christ to bring about this change in the direction of human consciousness, a change in the way that humans connect with the spiritual world. And he poses the thought experiment. What would have happened if humanity had proceeded in the direction it was, with a gradual decline of the old animistic way of connecting with the spiritual world? It would have just experienced a slide into naturalism to an even greater extent than has actually occurred. And some initiative was needed to prevent that inexorable slide into naturalism. And it was the gift of the spirit to be within, so there was a new and different way of connecting with the spiritual world. It's an unWhiggish way of placing Christ in evolutionary context. And I'm not sure how strongly I want to argue for either this Jungian or Barthelian way of connecting Christ with evolution, but I do want at least to say that there are ways of doing evolutionary Christology that lean less heavily on the idea of progress than many have, and which are fruitful and which deserve further exploration. And then I think I've been tough as line. I think that's a suitable place for me to draw breath.